Mr. President, I want to begin by thanking all of you for being here today, represented in this room, with notable exceptions of some of my old friends. What's represented here in this room are the finest minds in the country, representing a wide range of views across the political, ideological, and academic spectrum. And today, we're asking you to help us begin to tackle the challenges of our nation's long-term fiscal situation. We are going to explore how we got where we are and begin to debate where we need to head. And we hope this summit will generate a healthy debate, because we truly believe that the best course is to arrive at the best answers is to have that debate. It won't be easy, to state the obvious. I think we all know that we've inherited unprecedented budget deficits, and this has made all the more difficult the nearly unprecedented economic challenges the country is facing today. So the problem will not be solved overnight. That's news to no one in this room. But we want to be clear. As we take the steps that we must to get through the crisis we're in now, we will not lose sight of the long term. We will not lose sight of the need to tackle unmet needs, for health care reform, to deal with the energy policy that we need, and so many other challenges that are going to determine what the 21st century looks like. We must be direct with the American people about the budget difficulties and the choices we have to make, and we should be straightforward with them throughout this whole process. I've always believed that in the toughest moments, we are presented with the greatest opportunities as a nation. There's no question this is a very tough moment, but it's also a real opportunity to both put our economy back on track and restore fiscal responsibility. And that's why we need all of you. Our first speaker today will be Dr. Mark Zandi. Dr. Zandi is the chief economist and co-founder of Moody's Economy.com, where he directs the company's research and consulting activities. He's one of the best big-picture guys in the business. His most recent book, Financial Shock, was widely praised for its lucid explanation of the housing bust. What's less well known about Mark is that he donated the royalties from that book to a fund to invest in low-wealth neighborhoods. He's also an economic advisor to John McCain's campaign, and I'm glad he's here with us today. Following Mark will be Robert Greenstein, founder and executive director of the invaluable Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Bob and the Center are very well known to us, as they have been the go-to resource for consistently reliable analysis on matters of budgets and fiscal policy at every level of government. Bob was awarded the MacArthur Fellowship in 1996, and last year he received both the John W. Gardner Award for Independence and from Independent Sector and Heinz Award for Public Policy in recognition of his work to improve the economic outlook for many of America's poor citizens. And as I understand it, we're going to I'm now turning the program over to Mark, if I'm not mistaken. Mark, welcome.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. It was greatly appreciated, and the opportunity to speak this afternoon at this important meeting to address the nation's daunting long-term fiscal challenges. I'll make two broad points in my remarks. First, the Obama administration has inherited the worst fiscal situation in the nation's modern economic history. In the year ending this January, the federal budget deficit was approaching $1 trillion, equal to nearly 7% of the nation's GDP. This is the largest budget deficit since in the midst of World War II. Our fiscal problems reflect in significant part the rapidly eroding economy. The current economic downturn is on track to be the longest, most severe, and broadest-based recession since the Great Depression of the 1930s. More than 3.6 million jobs have been lost since the economy began losing jobs a year ago, and recent job losses have intensified to nearly over 500,000 per month. Job losses are occurring in nearly all occupations, every industry, and across all regions of the country. 42 states, by my reckoning, are in recession, and those states not in recession are not too far behind. Nearly everyone is being affected by this downturn, either through a lost job, lost hours and wages, a lost home, or a cracked nest egg. Job losses are undermining personal income and payroll tax revenue. Corporate tax revenues have collapsed with corporate earnings, and the reeling stock market is undermining capital gain revenues. Government outlays are increasing quickly as economically distressed households put increasing demands on government services. My second point is that our long-term fiscal problems will be magnified many times over unless policymakers are successful in quickly stemming the current economic and financial crisis. This requires an aggressive federal policy response, which will result in even larger budget deficits in the near term. This may seem counterintuitive, but with consumers, businesses, and our global trading partners panicked and retrenching, only the federal government has the resources necessary to quell the panic and stabilize the economy. The administration's policy response, including fiscal stimulus, a financial stability plan to shore up the financial system, and a foreclosure mitigation plan to stem rising foreclosures, should work to short-circuit the three vicious cycles spinning in our economy. The recently passed fiscal stimulus plan is large, some $800 billion, and reasonably well-designed, including tax cuts, help to hard-press state and local governments and unemployed workers, and increased infrastructure spending. Stimulus will soon work to stem the vicious cycle in the job market, in which millions in lost jobs are undermining consumer spending and forcing businesses to lay off even more workers. The financial stability plan is designed to end the vicious cycle in the financial system in which credit losses are undermining the system's capital, costing the economy more jobs and creating even more credit problems. The financial crisis, which began nearly 2 years ago, has devolved to the point that projected losses on the system's loans and securities are expected to total nearly $2.5 trillion, equal to a loss rate of more than 10%. The financial stability plan will provide more capital to the system and work to rid the system of its badly performing assets. The third vicious cycle is spinning in our housing market, in which record foreclosures are undercutting house prices, pushing millions of homeowners underwater, where their home is worth less than the debt they owe on their home, and thus forcing more foreclosures. The foreclosure mitigation plan unveiled last week is a strong effort at putting an end to this cycle by facilitating loan modifications that significantly reduce mortgage payments for hard-pressed homeowners. These households now have a fighting chance to hold on to their home. The unprecedented economic and financial crisis requires an equally unprecedented policy response. This does carry substantial costs. The federal budget deficit, which topped $450 billion in fiscal year 2008, is expected to rise, by my forecast, over $1.5 trillion in fiscal 2009 and remain equally as high in 2010. Borrowing by the Treasury will be even higher. There will also be substantial long-term costs to extricate the government from the financial system. Unintended consequences of all these actions taken in such a short period will be considerable. These are our problems for another day, however. The financial system is in disarray, and the economy struggles are intensifying. Policymakers must be aggressive. Whether from a natural disaster, a terrorist attack, or a financial calamity, crises of the magnitude of the current one only end with overwhelming government action. The cost to taxpayers of all this will be significant, but a less aggressive response would cost taxpayers measurably more. Only if our economy soon finds its bearings will addressing problems so important to righting our long-term fiscal situation, such as the rapidly rising cost of health care, energy independence, and comprehensive tax reform, be within our reach. Thank you.
Mr. President, Mr. Vice President, distinguished guests, I'm honored to be here. I have a lot to cover in just a few minutes, so with your indulgence, I'll get right to it. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities recently analyzed the fiscal outlook through mid-century, and our results are similar to those of the Office of Management and Budget, the Congressional Budget Office, and others. Simply put, the long-term fiscal picture is unsustainable. If we do not change current policies, the national debt, which now equals about 45% of the gross domestic product, will soar to about 300% of GDP by the year 2050. By then, interest payments on the debt alone would consume 14% of GDP, more than we spent last year on Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and all other entitlements combined. We must avoid such an explosion of debt. To do that, we must make sure that the debt does not consistently grow faster than the overall economy, which in turn means that over time, annual deficits should not average more than 2 to 3% of GDP. But under current policies, even after the economy starts to grow again, deficits will never fall below 4% of GDP and eventually will go much higher. So we are on the path to the very debt explosion we must avoid. What's driving this problem? Let me start with what's not driving it. First, the recent economic recovery package is not driving the problem. That package is temporary, and it increased the size of the long-term fiscal gap by only about 0.1 percentage point of GDP. Its costs are dwarfed by the bigger, longer-lasting factors I'm about to describe. Second, entitlement programs in general are not driving the problem. Entitlements other than the three big ones, Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, have actually been falling as a share of the economy and will continue to do so. So what is driving the problem? The increases projected in federal spending in coming decades as a share of the economy are due entirely to the projected growth in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, which in turn is driven by rising health care costs and the aging of the population. The single biggest factor is rising health care costs, not just in Medicare and Medicaid, but throughout our health care system. For more than 30 years, costs per patient in Medicare, Medicaid, and private health care have all risen at about the same rate and much faster than the economy. If health care costs per patient were somehow to rise at the same rate that the economy grows on a per capita basis, rather than growing faster, the vast majority of the long-term fiscal gap would disappear. So we face a daunting, system-wide healthcare problem. Most experts agree that we cannot hold Medicare and Medicaid costs over time to a significantly lower rate of growth than private sector healthcare growth. The public and private sectors use the same providers and the same treatments. Holding the growth in just the public sector to a much lower rate would lead either to rationing by income or, more likely, to lots of cost shifting. Providers would raise prices even more on private health care to compensate for the lower public sector reimbursements. Two more points about health care on which most budget and health care experts agree. First, if we want to slow the rate of growth in health care costs system-wide, then Medicare needs to help lead that effort to institute payment and delivery system reforms that the private sector then picks up. And second, because health care costs are rising mostly due to advances in medical technology, many of which do improve health and prolong life, we almost certainly won't be able to slow health care cost growth so much that it rises no faster than the economy. And that means we also need to make other significant changes in budget and tax policy to avoid a debt explosion. What else must we do? We will need to restore the long-term solvency of Social Security. Some people assume that Social Security benefits are very generous and there's plenty of room to reduce them. And a balanced Social Security solvency plan should certainly look at all aspects of the program. Yet, the room for benefit reductions is likely to be more modest than you may think. Social Security checks now replace about 39% of the average worker's pre-retirement wages, less than similar programs in other Western countries. And because of the scheduled increase in the retirement age, which operates as an across-the-board benefit reduction, and the projected growth in Medicare premiums, which are deducted from Social Security checks, that figure will gradually fall from 39% to about 32% over the next two decades. In addition, we cannot overlook the impact that recent losses in 401ks and other retirement plans that supplement Social Security will have on retirees' incomes. Finally, revenues. The long-term fiscal problem is, of course, the mismatch between spending and revenues. And with such a large long-term gap, it's hard to see how to avert a debt explosion without major policy changes in both spending and revenues. Current tax policies would produce revenues somewhat below the historical average of 18.4% of GDP. Yet revenues at that level would have fallen short of balancing the budget in every year over the past 30 years. In fact, in all 4 years of that period, when we did balance the budget, revenues totaled between 20 and 21% of GDP. So all of this suggests that to address the daunting long-term fiscal problem, everything on both the spending and tax sides of the budget will have to be on the table, and that we will need to place a particular emphasis on health care costs and health care reform. It seems inescapable that shared sacrifice is going to be necessary. In conclusion, we will need to act before mounting debt and interest payments make the challenge of addressing this problem even bigger and more painful than it already is. Thank you. It's now my honor to introduce someone who for years I've said and thought was part of my hope for the future of the country and whom President Obama has had the great wisdom to name as Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Peter Orszag.
Thank you, Bob, and thank you all for coming to this summit. Our nation is being forced to grapple with a pair of trillion-dollar deficits. One is the trillion-dollar deficit between what the economy is producing each year and what it could produce, and the other is the trillion-dollar budget deficits that this administration is inheriting. The first deficit, the trillion-dollar income gap this year, is an urgent crisis. The longer it persists, the more jobs that are lost, the more income that households lose, and the more businesses that are closed. The Recovery Act that was enacted earlier this month is intended to address that crisis, and I thank all of you for working on that Recovery Act. The second deficit, the budget deficit, may be somewhat less urgent, but it's no less important. Over the medium to long term, the nation is on an unsustainable fiscal course. And to be responsible, we must begin the process of fiscal reform now. That's why the President convened this summit today, because we can no longer let the urgent get in the way of the important. In charting a new fiscal course, we need to be clear in diagnosing the problem. The single most important thing we can do to put this nation back on a sustainable long-term fiscal course is slow the growth rate of health care costs. As Bob Greenstein already emphasized, health care is the key to our fiscal future. So to my fellow budget hawks in this room and in the rest of the country, let me be very clear. Healthcare reform is entitlement reform. The path to fiscal responsibility must run directly through healthcare. We also must recognize that reforms to Medicare and Medicaid will only succeed in the context of slowing the overall growth rate of healthcare costs. Improving the efficiency of the health system so that we get better results for less money is therefore not just or even primarily a budget issue. It would also provide direct help to struggling families, since healthcare costs are reducing workers' take-home pay to a degree that is both underappreciated and unnecessarily large. And for many states, health care is increasingly crowding out other priorities, like higher education, which in turn is leading to higher tuition and painful cutbacks at state universities. All of this is why the president has said time and again that he is committed to reforming the health system this year. And with his leadership and the hard work of everyone in this room, we can reform health care, start to bend the curve on long-term costs, and get our economy back on a path of long-term fiscal sustainability. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the President of the United States, Barack Obama.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Thank you. Thank you. Please, have a seat. Thank you very much. Thank you to Mark and Bob and to Peter. It is wonderful to see the speaker here, and we've got our representative. I don't see Harry here, but we've got Dick Durbin in his stead. Mitch, thank you for being here. John Boehner, to all the congressional leadership, thank you. My administration came into office 1 month ago in the depths of an economic crisis unlike any that we've seen in generations. And we recognized that we needed to act boldly and decisively and quickly, and that's precisely what we did. Within our first 30 days in office, we passed the most sweeping economic recovery package in history to create or save 3.5 million new jobs, provide relief to struggling families, and lay the foundation for long-term growth and prosperity. And I had an opportunity to talk to the nation's governors today, and both Republicans and Democrats had ideas about how they are going to use that money to make sure that people are put back to work and that we can stem some of the job loss that's taking place. I also laid out my housing plan to break the cycle of falling home values and rising foreclosures that's devastated so many communities. And we put forth a financial stability plan to start shoring up our banks so we can free up credit and jumpstart lending and restore confidence in our financial system. Now, these are all extraordinary but necessary measures to address this economic emergency. And as has already been noted, they will come at a cost. This administration has inherited a $1.3 trillion deficit, the largest in our nation's history, and our investments to rescue our economy will add to that deficit in the short term. We also have long-term challenges, health care, energy, education, and others, that we can no longer afford to ignore. But I want to be very clear, if the message was not effectively delivered by the three previous speakers, we cannot and will not sustain deficits like these without end. Contrary to the prevailing wisdom in Washington these past few years, we cannot simply spend as we please and defer the consequences to the next budget, the next administration, or the next generation. We are paying the price for these deficits right now. In 2008 alone, we paid $250 billion in interest on our debt, one in every 10 taxpayer dollars. That is more than three times what we spent on education that year, more than seven times what we spent on VA health care. So if we confront this crisis without also confronting the deficits that help cause it, we risk sinking into another crisis down the road as our interest payments rise, our obligations come due, confidence in our economy erodes, and our children and our grandchildren are unable to pursue their dreams because they're saddled with our debts. And that's why today I'm pledging to cut the deficit we inherited by half by the end of my first term in office. Now, this will not be easy. It will require us to make difficult decisions and face challenges we've long neglected. But I refuse to leave our children with a debt that they cannot repay. And that means taking responsibility right now in this administration for getting our spending under control. We'll start by being honest with ourselves about the magnitude of our deficits. For too long, our budget process in Washington has been an exercise in deception, a series of accounting tricks to hide the extent of our spending and the shortfalls in our revenue and hope that the American people won't notice. Budgeting certain expenditures for just 1 year when we know we'll incur them every year for 5 or 10. Budgeting $0 for the Iraq War. Zero. for future years, even when we knew the war would continue, budgeting no money for natural disasters as if we would ever go 12 months without a single flood, fire, hurricane, or earthquake. We do ourselves no favors by hiding the truth about what we spend. In order to address our fiscal crisis, we're going to have to be candid about its scope. And that's why the budget I will introduce later this week will look ahead 10 years and will include a full and honest accounting of the money we plan to spend and the deficits we will likely incur. To start reducing these deficits, I've committed to going through our budget line by line to root out waste and inefficiency, a process that Peter and our administration, our team, has already begun. And I'll soon be instructing each member of my cabinet to go through every item in their budgets as well. And already we've seen how much money we can save. Just in the last 30 days, take one example. The Department of Agriculture has moved some of its training programs online, saving an estimated $1.3 million a year. They're modernizing their financial management system, saving an estimated $17.5 million. They're saving tens of thousands of dollars by cutting back on conferences and travel and other small expenses that add up over time. So we will replicate these efforts throughout the federal government, eliminating programs that don't work to make room for ones that do, and making the ones that we keep work better. We'll end the payments to agribusiness that don't need them, and eliminate the no-bid contracts that have wasted billions in Iraq. We'll end the tax breaks for companies shipping jobs overseas, and we'll stop the fraud and abuse in our Medicare program. And we will reinstate the pay-as-you-go rule that we followed during the 1990s, the rule that helped us start this new century with a $236 billion surplus. In recent years, we've strayed from this rule, and the results speak for themselves. The pay-go approach is based on a very simple concept. You don't spend what you don't have. So if we want to spend, we'll need to find somewhere else to cut. This is the rule that families across this country follow every single day, and there's no reason why their government shouldn't do the same. Now, I want to be very clear. While we are making important progress towards fiscal responsibility this year, in this budget, this is just the beginning. In the coming years, we'll be forced to make more tough choices and do much more to address our long-term challenges, from the rising cost of health care that Peter described, which is the single most pressing fiscal challenge we face by far, to the long-term solvency of Social Security. In the end, however, if we want to rebuild our economy and restore discipline and honesty to our budget, we will need to change the way we do business here in Washington. We're not going to be able to fall back into the same old habits and make the same inexcusable mistakes, the repeated failure to act as our economy spiraled deeper into crisis, the casual dishonesty of hiding irresponsible spending with clever accounting tricks, the costly overruns, the fraud and abuse, the endless excuses. This is exactly what the American people rejected when they went to the polls. They sent us here to usher in a new era of responsibility in Washington, to start living within our means again and being straight with them about where their tax dollars are going, and empowering them with the information they need to hold all of us, their representatives, accountable. So that's why I've called this summit today, and why I've invited leaders from both sides of the aisle, because we all have a role to play in this work. I believe it is time for a frank conversation about the fiscal challenges we face. They're challenges that concern every single one of us, no matter where we are on the political spectrum. So today I hope that all of you will start talking with each other and exchanging ideas. I want you to question each other, challenge each other, question me and my team, challenge us, and work together not just to identify problems, but to identify solutions. And that's the purpose of the breakout sessions that are starting right now. I know that each of you bring a wealth of experience and expertise on a broad range of topics. I appreciate your willingness to participate in these sessions. I expect that this process will be engaging and productive, and I look forward to hearing the results when you report back later this afternoon. So thank you very much, all of you, for participating. All right.